All right, good morning and welcome to the first burning platform of I think we've got a couple
in
of
the
weeks.
New studio.
But we've got how many weeks? You said 4 or 5 weeks left till the elections. It's very exciting. Well, you've already seen who our guest is. Pumi is sitting right next to him. He is none other than the leader of Bosa. He is Musi Maimane. And just in case we didn't know, your name is on the jacket.
Deliberately.
Very smart jacket,
why?
By the way.
And there are people who don't know your name.
No, I must remind myself. It's for my kids, actually.
Let me start off with a real softball for you, because I think it's so sweet you posted a picture with your mother.
Yeah, it was my mother's birthday. Special, special, special woman. I love her to bits, and she is unbelievable.
Lerato.
Kalerato. It just means with love. Her name is Bandlagazi Maimane. My mother is actually Xhosa, so ndiyathetha when I want to. And that's why I'm bilingual. So it was nice. It was nice to see her.
Nice that you shared that with all of us. Because, you know, a lot of these politicians, you don't want to dig too deep into their personal relationships with their family, because they can be terrifically unhealthy. But in your case, it's nice. It's nice to see.
It could be drama.
So, all right. Musi Maimane, we actually had the pleasure of your company not so long ago. So out of all the political leaders, they're going to say that we've had you in more than anyone else, even though last time we spoke to you was last year. And you can't really say it was the run-up to the elections. We had a nice conversation. We talked a little bit about Bosa. I remember I said to you that one thing I will be very grateful to you for forevermore, and there are more and more people in the political realm who are starting to realize this is important, is the independent candidates, which wasn't a thing in South Africa. You know, we take things for granted. We make a lot of progress, and then we go, oh, but we want more progress, instead of going, wow, look how far we've come. So that was a big deal. But I saw this week you've brought in under the fold so many more small parties. Mm. Someone criticized you immediately on social media and said, oh, well, this is typical. Here's the guy who was talking about independent candidates, and look at him now. He's a party man, and he's running this in a party way. Shall we start there?
Yeah, it's a good place to start. Firstly, congratulations on your new home.
I think this is a great facility,
and it's super to be here.
Thank you.
The fight ultimately wasn't just about independence only, right? It was that we could have a direct election of politicians of any kind. So even if you stand under a party, at least if you are in Sandton, let the people of Sandton know so-and-so is standing for them.
Yeah.
This is what they stand for. And if they don't do their jobs, you have to fight them back, and they get given money to run offices, and that's how the thing is, right? So that's what we were fighting for. So we wanted the entire amendment of the Electoral Act so that that could be achieved. And one day we'll get a direct election of the president, because it's anomalous that the president is elected by a party and none of us kind of know what's going on. But what's happened in this instance is that when the bill arrived in parliament, they did what is called malicious compliance with the constitution. They just said, we'll unstitch a few things, just allow independents to stand. The problem with that is that someone can stand as an independent, but their whole constituency is an entire province. So in Gauteng, it might be easy to travel from the Vaal to Pretoria. Yeah. But if you're in the Northern Cape, how do you get from Kimberley to Springbok and get 90,000 votes and only that seat? Whereas a party gets 90,000 votes and 2 seats, potentially.
Yeah.
So this is about understanding that the rules are baked in a particular way. We established a party called Build One South Africa, invited many of these candidates, actually forced them to say, go get signatures from your community. Many of the candidates I met for the first time when I saw them on our list.
Okay.
Because they came from communities. Their communities own them in that they can remove them. And ultimately, we have then the additional benefit of the second lot of allocation of seats, which is proportional representative, which is that then actually, if you do get 100,000 votes, you don't just get the seat for the person. You get 2 seats, or you can potentially get 3 if they split them up proportionally. So I actually think it's smart. I think it's a way of making sure that we can get more people who share our values, who have a vision for this country, to represent South Africans in parliament. And I actually think that when we arrive in parliament with more MPs, we can then fight so that one day actually we can get
the
right system.
Is it your fault that we now have 3 ballot papers?
I'm afraid.
That's what I realized when I was reading, because I still don't understand. Someone asked me the other day, why do we have three ballot papers? So I had to look it up. Yeah. And the one is for 200 seats in the National Assembly, but that's only parties.
Yes.
The other one is for the other 200 seats, which is provincial, and that's party and independence.
Independence.
And then the third one is for
provincial. Yeah.
Provincial.
Yeah.
Right. So this is partly your fault.
To your point, it's a step in the right direction. But I think what is sad for me is that I'm not sure the IEC has done enough of a job of educating people. If you informed had to Google and look it up and all of those things, you can imagine the gogos sitting in Limpopo, what they will be thinking once they present it with three ballots and how they vote. So their short answer is just vote Bossa on all three.
All right. Well, that's easy.
It's easy. All right. I'll make things easy for people.
Well, I don't want to get bogged down in that nitty gritty, because I think that that's a much bigger conversation. And there are lots of pros and cons, including in terms of a con, including what we see in KZN with all of the political killings that have been on the rise. Because when you are not protected, when you are an independent and you're not protected within a party system, you are more at risk. It's one of the things that leading up to our first election was a very big consideration for the drafters of the of our constitution with regard to how we vote and why proportional representation was a thing. But I want to know if you think that you have done enough since 2022, when you launched Build One South Africa, to get the number of seats you want to get.
I just want to, and I agree with you, we mustn't get bogged down on the electoral system. But I also want to highlight the fact that political killings are often a function of intra-party contestation. They're very less to do with public representation in that sense. It's people who sit inside the same party, fight over tenders, they fight over multiple things. The Moerane report highlights some of these killings. Just because you have a power of association within a party, you own the right of the power of disassociation, is what the Constitution says. And therefore, your great difficulty is that often you find these are wars of people who say, I was meant to be this number on the list and you got it, and therefore we start the violence on the
score. Yeah, but that thing, right? You can...
Yeah.
Again, so, I don't... look, yeah. But that thing, within the party, the inter-party contestation is one thing, and within a party, you can always be redeployed, right? If you're having an intra-party contestation, but where you have, and KZN in particular... Yeah. Being a problem where you have IFP, where you have independence, when you have the ANC. And because the minute a councillor, for instance, has died, you don't get the party replacing that person. You get a by-election. Right?
But the people being killed are not independent.
Because up until now, up until this last general election, there were no independents. You had to be part of a party system. But again,
councillors can be independents.
If you choose to get bogged down in this and not use your time talking about Musa,
yeah, let's talk about.
I'm happy to keep going
I'm sufficiently chastised.
Okay. So, do you think you have done enough?
Look,
to get what you are looking for on the 29th.
We've worked extraordinarily hard. First things first, this is the evidence of the issue. For a party that's been going now for a year and a half, and since 2022, as you correctly point out, we've been able to attract just over 140 candidates who are extraordinary South Africans. This is a fresh breed of talent that I don't think many parties have been able to produce, to be honest. When I think about people like Ayanda Ali, when I think about people like Nobuntu Hlazo Webster, people like Kathy Burman.
These people
are making a
splash, which for young and new coming people to the political realm, you don't see a lot of that. Yeah.
New and fresh. And they're not bogged down in old party politics. They really are coming in to deliver a strong message of here's what they stand for, and politics then not being left up to politicians. That's the first. The second thing is we've been able to, the signatures exercise was an important test for us because it had to ask us the question, could you be able to amass a movement across all nine provinces and be able to garner the appropriate signatures in all nine provinces, in all demographics, in all, if you like, economic status, and more seriously, across all language groups. And we've been able to achieve that across the country, which is an important landmark to put on the table. The IEC only asked us for 60,000. We went for 140,000. Thirdly, when you look around, we've been able to raise at least sufficient financial muscle through really democratization of people coming on board and saying, let me help you. We've put up posters across the country. We've put up structures across the country because politics is about mobilizing citizens from the ground up and being able to ensure that your message gets through. And on even my own personal standing in society, it's been the hard yards of being able to say, have you got ideas that people can resonate with? And I message on a job in every home. When you sit down with people and you start to speak to them about actually the government policy that says only over under 35 can work in public works program, let's make sure that we can put jobs in every single home, in every single person's home, that message is resonating and we've been able to deliver it across multiple channels. So we're not building a typical political party in that sense. We've rejected certain excesses of a political party, having a council, a senate, and crazy things that people don't really understand. We've allowed people to be full participants of BOSA and been able to mobilize in their communities. And I'm confident that going into these elections, when people are looking around and making a choice, they have to answer this question. Which leaders do I want? Do I want a non-racial vision? And do I want a party that ultimately can be able to deliver against that promise? And I think we've done the work to do that.
So it's how never many seats are you hunting?
Yeah, look, we are pushing for, I know it's a brave call, but we've always wanted to, at least at a low point, we've got to say to ourselves, how do we get between 20 or just above 20 seats? And so we're going, we're pushing hard across the country. And what I'm saying is, to use a football analogy, BOSA wants to play Champions League next year. So if you follow how Champions Leagues, the top four clubs play Champions League, we want to be in that league.
So 5% of the vote is what you're looking for?
Between 5 to 8%. So that's what we want to go for.
Well, there's a lot happening in this country's politics at the moment. It is not unforeseeable that one small party or a group of them together could end up scoring a really big goal, to use the football analogy a little bit more. What would be the most important priorities? I'm stealing Pumi's thunder in this because she always asks the political leaders, and we've had pretty much all of them except for three parties in. They're still coming. You can guess which three are being difficult. So what are the three first things and the main things that you would focus on should you be able to influence things a little more than your 5%?
Yeah, look.
Best case scenario.
The most important thing that South Africa has lost in the last 15 years is the capability of government. The state is corrupted. It is incompetent. We were just speaking earlier about just the basic process of getting an ID. People can't, it's hard work. Basic systems of being able to say, how do you account? So if you were to say to me, what would a My Money type presidency look like in the first 100 days? I can assure you, you'll spend all of your life making sure the best work for government so that we can deliver. Because that's absolutely crucial. You can have all the dreams and ambitions you like. The reality of it is that if you are incapable of delivering against that, you're going to struggle. That's why even in our model of selecting candidates, we wanted the best so that you can send them to departments so they can work hard. In as far as what is important for citizens, it's job stupid, right? Like it's a famous line.
Sure.
And we've got to focus on making sure that we create not only the conditions to deliver jobs, but be deliberate about it. And that's what the last 5 years for me outside of parliament have meant.
Okay, but I'm going to push you a little bit further on that one, because if Canton were here, he would be asking you how.
Yeah, then that's
how
what I want.
How does the government create jobs other than government jobs, which is just a drain on the taxpayers?
Well, on the first instances, it's job creation is about, you know, cultivating a good garden in some ways. And that's the fundamental role of government, right? If you can't keep the lights on, no jobs are going to be created. That's a fact. And so we've created a model upon how we can eradicate load shedding almost entirely by introducing SMRs to make sure the lights do stay on. You cannot fix it unless you fix Transnet and split it into two component parts, one for some of the ports and some for the logistics business. And I've always said that we don't need a Ministry of Transport. We need a Ministry of Logistics because that way we can move goods in and out of the country easily and more effectively. But it's also about making sure that commuter transport is easier. Because if you think about how much people spend trying to get to work, it can be up to 40% of their income. So let's make that aspect easier.
Sure.
The third dynamic is, if unless we solve particularly the issue around crime, investment dries up because skills can't move backwards and forwards, both domestically and internationally. So we've spoken about decentralizing police so that the intelligence sits lower to the ground, and there are models that show this. So that's about the garden part. But the actual delivery part, I've proposed, and I've seen this evidence of it myself because we've worked in private services, that we create a fund of about just 220 billion rands that invests particularly in the township economy so that SMMEs can begin to thrive. And what you do post that is that you partner with them from a funding point of view. You stimulate infrastructure build, particularly in townships. Why are we not running, instead of running a BPO center here in Sandton, why can't we run it in Alex? The internet is exactly the same. You put it there so that not only is there a job in every home, but there's a job closer to home so that people can work closer to home. That's on one level. Furthermore, along with that, in the stimulus of trying to make sure that micro industry becomes medium, by helping it fund it, giving it the appropriate mentorship and the training, you can develop it further. And I don't want to dismiss the fact that government has an important role in terms of expanded public works program and running a national civilian service. So I've made the case to say, every matriculant must be able to, after that, spend a year where we pay them for the full year. They spend 6 months working in government jobs, and then they spend the second 6 months making sure that they can deploy those skills. That's internship and training, so that you fix for not only values, but you fix for the skills part. And then I think the last thing, the one sector of society that we've lost as a country is in our manufacturing sector. So let's use two pieces of technology that all of us use. We all use microwaves. We all use kettles. On the technology of manufacturing kettles, South Africa's output is only 4% of the kettle market. Surely we should be able to create the manufacturing processing that ensures that we can manufacture that stuff and be able to deploy it into our own markets. If we don't, and I say this with all the gusto I can put together, if we don't educate our kids, if we don't skill them, you are rendering them to permanent unemployment and unemployability.
Yeah.
So the, what underpins all of this is a skilling for jobs. And so we've worked out which sectors we prioritize, where the jobs are going to come from. And I'm committed to making sure that in the next 5 years, we can deliver at least 2 million jobs.
So I hear you saying two things which sound very similar to one other party. And that is about a capable state and deploying the right people in the right places, which sounds a lot like cadet deployment. Are you a DA light?
Far from, in some instances. You know, economic policy is a funny thing, because this question about what are you at the light of often comes up as a function of...
Because the ANC light is the DA, right?
No. It is what the DA say you tried to turn them into. That's why I'm asking you if you are a DA light.
List those two things again. A capable state. Mm-hmm. Which I think a lot of people in this country are likely to be a fan of. Mm-hmm. I mean, most service delivery protests are about the incapable state, right? Mm-hmm. So that shouldn't be controversial. It shouldn't necessarily be reasons for you to
be the light of anything.
Yeah. And then the other one was?
The other one was about deploying differently.
Good. People on merit.
When I talked about deployment, you know, I've worked with the Public Service Commission, which is the institution tasked with the job of making sure that the framework of government is clear about what skills are needed where. So I use the term deployment, but it's actually a false term. So if you pardon me, I would remove that. What I really am trying to allude to is to say, if you want a CEO of Eskom, the Public Service Commission is able to look at it and say, given where Eskom is at, we need an engineer, not a lawyer. Regardless of the fact that the two people are skilled, but we need an engineer. Therefore, when you've crafted the job spec, go out and shop for the best engineer that you can put at Eskom. Or if you're looking for a director general in, for example, in the Ministry of Logistics, let's figure out someone who's done that. Or in the Ministry of Digitization, which is something I'm very passionate about, let's get the best person to be able to do so. So one of the problems of this deployment culture that you are alluding to has been a mismatch of skills more than anything. Right? even the fact that people can choose people from their own parties and send them there. The crime has been that you have water problems, but you send doctors there. And as nice as it is, sounds, the problem with it is that a doctor cannot fix my water problems. I'd rather send them elsewhere or employ them elsewhere. So we've got to be able to craft the skeleton that says, actually, here are the best skills for these jobs and begin to make it possible for the most professional people to come through. This is true for Japan. This is true for South Korea. This is true for countries that if you started them in the 1994, in the same period as us, we're in similar GDP terms, but they've outstripped us by far by making sure that their ability to deliver is actually far more effective by employing the best people. So that's what I meant by that point. On this issue of stimulus of SMMEs, et cetera, you can argue the case about whether it's light of anything. Actually, I spent much of January in institutions dealing with developmental economists, both at Harvard and MIT, and looking at various models all over the world. The reality of it is that in some ways, when you look at economic policy, there are some fundamentals you've got to get right. And they're similar. Anyone who wants to think that they're going to come up with something new under the sun is not going to achieve that. The reality is that you've got to get behind people who actually create jobs, make it easier for them, support them as best as you can, help them with social, financial, and social capital so that they can be able to get the right mentorship to deliver jobs. So all of this doesn't make you light of anything. It just makes you someone who is focused on saying, how do we deliver jobs?
Let's be realistic. I mean, it's highly unlikely that BOSA are going to get an outright majority. So you'll have to work with other people. Now, you've shown that you could work with other people inside of the party. You've just brought all these other parties in this week, which I think is a story. Who will you work with and who will you not work with? Because the reality is you're still going to have the DA, ANC, EFF. These guys are going to be there.
Sure.
MK.
Sure.
So how prepared are you to work with them and how well do you think you will be received by them?
Yeah, look, we've foregrounded every type of collaboration or any form of coalition with the idea that we've got a 10-point plan and we need to stick to that. You know, in 2016, to when I led the DA, we led the coalitions in Joburg, which eventually elected Herman Mashaba as mayor, and they stuck it out for 3 years. It wasn't even about Herman or anything like that. It was that we sat down and said, here are the things that we're going to do in government, and anyone who wants to work with us must focus on those things,
yeah.
Right? And so you spend 3 years, and then you focus all the energy on collaborating with leaders, keeping them goal-oriented so that it's not ego-driven, and you make sure that you eradicate some central things like corruption, make sure that the best people work for government, and you can ask Herman, you can ask any mayor I've worked with. The simple question I put before them is, what are you doing about restoring dignity of people by delivering basic services and ensuring that ultimately we deliver economic growth in all those cities? That was the mantra. I said to them, that's the focus. That's all you've got to do. Now, to come back to the 2024 conversation, we have to, again, with a 10-point plan that Eskom, logistics, safety, education, digitization, looking at what we do around healthcare, improvement of certain infrastructural costs, across those things, then let's sit down with parties and negotiate. And on one theme, when you say you want to eradicate corruption, you can't work with corrupt people to eradicate corruption. So with respect, it would be impossible to work with the ANC. Not for the simple reason that they've shown clear
but
evidence.
You're saying it would break down at the point where corruption comes up. You wouldn't just out of hand say, like, we're not going to work with you. But at the point where you're sitting at the table and they say, listen, this corruption thing, you're going to go, hmm.
I mean, even at this point, you could almost say, hmm, because here are people listed in the Zondo Commission.
Yeah.
And they will be serving as members of parliament. So your problem with it is that we've got this hanging thing. And I've asked the questions. I mean, we wouldn't have Palapala today had I not asked President Ramaphosa about a donation to his own campaign that then unraveled into this there's money in your couch business. we wouldn't have the Zondo Commission if I not asked Zuma about Nkebisi Jonas's testimony and reporting it to the public protector. So that's been work of fighting. Now suddenly you've been fighting these two major cases. You arrive in parliament and then suddenly people are going, we no longer want to look into this Palapala issue or actually the Zondo Commission. Let's just file it under a little bit of a cupboard and then move on from there. I think it would be hypocritical and I think it'd be wrong. So let's get on to the business of, if you want to work with us, let's fight corruption. to the parties. I think the pathway for South Africa is a grand coalition of the opposition. I really think so. I think it does two things. It gives the ANC time on the bench, which I think is necessary. I don't think the ANC talks about renewal. The best place to renew is outside government. You can't renew and fly a plane at the same time. Sit down. The second thing is a grand opposition that works in this manner. Now, I know many people might think I'm crazy for saying this. I don't think you can form a formal coalition with the EFF. But when it comes to issues of voting around the budget, electing a president, a speaker, I think you could sit down with the EFF and say, we need your vote for these things. Because I think these things are going to be important if we're going to bring change. We're never going to agree on ideology.
They have come to the party on some of those.
And some of these things can come forward.
We've seen
on matters of how do you form that government. If you were clear in your head, this is what a cabinet looks like, and then you began to say, how do I attract across the political parties, the best finance minister, the best person who does digitization, all of that, bring them all together and form a cabinet that will represent the best of South Africa and deliver for South Africa. And then furthermore, say to yourself, on the plan, here's what we achieved. Then you strip away whether I have issues with the DA or I have issues with the PA, I have issues with this.
I agree. And I mean, do you think egos can be put aside though, Musi?
They have been before.
Because people say you have an ego. People have said all the other political party leaders have egos. Often it's meant as an insult, right?
Do you think it's
possible?
Yeah, I certainly think so. I think that given even the conversations we've been having now, I think that there's a... Of the leaders I speak to, and this is a privilege of just being... circumstances have brought me to a point being married across the color line, speaks multiple languages. You've got the option to be able to speak to everybody. Mm-hmm. Literally, I can pick up the phone to Julius, to Herman, to Peter Groenewald, to John, to anybody, and we can have a conversation. And I think the conversations we've been having, I think, are better off today, given the existential issue of the country than they have been before.
That's all I need.
So I ask myself, it all sounds wonderful when you say it like this. You can pick up the phone, you can talk to anybody, and egos can be put aside. So I ask myself, why then, when you were within the official opposition party and you had all these skills presumably were there even when you were in that party, why did you walk away? Why did you not use that particular vehicle and get to this place?
Yeah.
Why were you unable to do that? And why must I believe that you can do it now outside of the official opposition?
So let me put it to you this way. When you had the freedom to do the things you want to do. So I'll use 2016. 2016 was a great example. We were in charge of the majority of the local government budget. I worked those coalitions and they held for the 3 years. So to talk about the skill and the correlation behind that, that is the work I did. Like the Electoral Amendment Bill, perhaps maybe not speaking extensively about all the DA issues, there were two challenges that I would want to highlight that made it near impossible to stay. On the first, actually, is that the reason today you have one South Africa is because it became patently clear to me that we would have two contestations of visions. One is I wanted one of one South Africa, and there were others genuinely who said the DA will become a minority party and that's what we've got to focus on. When you have that kind of clash, it means that on the issues you are going to fight for, when you've got to be fighting for the right of all South Africans to express their language, the DA will say, no, let's just rather just go fight in Stellenbosch just for this particular language group only. When your leadership, you're fighting hard to say, how do we make sure we've got a diverse caucus in parliament? And then people start to say, well, if you're not going to have this particular race of people, we're not going to campaign in an election because this is not something we share. When people then go speak to donors and make life difficult for you to raise money because they feel that their way is not being get as a party of minority, that becomes hard. It's unsustainable. Either you will die or the party will die. The second issue is that then the entire environment inside the organization became profoundly toxic. There were mornings, and I say this even when I think about it now, there were mornings I would wake up every day thinking, I would rather fight this for this country. But these battles that are inside the organization, where you are reading about your life in newspapers every day with forced distortions for weeks and weeks on end, you've got to come home and look at your wife. You've got to look at your kids. You've got to have your own well-being and then say to yourself, is it then worth it? Had I stayed in the DA, I can tell you as night follows day, I would have died. It just was unsustainable. So for my own soul, for my own well-being, and now I'm coming back into politics. Having, as the famous Roosevelt quote would say, tasted both defeat, but also success and victory. Having worked now in the private sector, having skilled myself a little bit more, I'm busy completing a PhD now. I'm a better human being than I was in 2019. And in some ways, as painful as it was, I'm grateful for the break, the hiatus you took that gave me the...
I saw an interesting comment here from Patrick. He said he's right about this grand coalition of the opposition. It's what I've pushed for the whole time. One of the reasons I'm irritated at the DA constantly going on about the PA is precisely this. But I mean, I'm glad Pumi brought this up because it's always going to haunt you, right? Yeah. This question about like why you left the DA. Why couldn't you do it in the DA? And there are a lot of people standing up for you here. In fact, I think it was Snipes who said, now you're getting down to business. Ask Pumi, he should have stayed. Okay, so I think that's interesting and it gives you an opportunity to explain yourself. But now you say that there's a different relationship with you and all these party leaders.
Yeah. You know... And funny enough, even when we managed to garner signatures, right, the calls that I got ranged as far as ANC senior leaders to opposition leaders who just phoned to congratulate because it's that opportunity. It's that sense of being able to not be, if you like, not willing to listen, not willing to hear the other argument. Sometimes, you know, when you hear parties, you actually interrogate them. You ask them, hey, what do you think about working with the DA? There's a term bandied around. They say the DA is arrogant. That's the point they make.
We had this discussion with John last week.
But I think what they really are trying to say is that the DA isn't willing to go, we hear you, and what does it mean? Now, let me give you a real practical example of how this thing works, right? I come back to this coalition discussion. I get a call from the city of Johannesburg saying, at the time, Herman Mashaba and them were proposing an additional 2% rate hike additional. Now you've got a dilemma because you need the EFF's votes to be able to pass that budget. Julius is saying for his constituency in Alexandra, they want no rate hikes. Now, no city can function without having to increase rate hikes to some degree. He has a point about his constituency. The DA of today simply says, stuff you. We're going to put the rate hikes anyways, and if the government collapses, so be it. I can remember spending a number of hours with Julia saying, where can we find each other on this issue? What are your actual issues, Ichel? What are the numbers here that we've got to play around with? What is the net loss? What are all of those things? We eventually settled on 1%, and the city could be able to afford some of that lack of increase, etc. But you know what? When you're willing to do that, you get a better deal. The coalition works and goes forward. So to me, all I'm trying to get through is that when you are freed up to do the work that you got to do, the relationship with those leaders is one of saying, why do we put country interests first? Let's go for it there. That's why even now, these parties that we've been able to bring together, some of them have got councillors in places and some of them as that. If you aspire to lead South Africa, you cannot not deal with the contradictions of this country. You have to accept that the hopes of one can equally be the fears of another. You have to accept that on one day you are in Alexander, on another you are in Sandton. You have to accept that there are others who say private healthcare must be the only way and the lack of government must be the thing. There are others who are saying we don't have another choice, we need government. You in the job of leadership is being able to find what I would like to consider this radical centrism, this idea of being able to bring the best of both worlds to the table and drive it forward. You have to manage contradictions. It's not black versus white in this country. It's black and white, colored and Indian by constitutional expressions. It is all of the above. It's rich and poor. You have to work with those contradictions. The lazy path is to say, well, I'm just a party for blacks, or I'm just a party for whites, or I'm just a party for coloreds or Indians or Christians or this or that. Once you are down that slipstream, then we don't have to think. We don't have to think through complexity. We just have to arrive and say, well, this is the view of the blacks, and so we can't debate the issue further.
So what's your vision for the country that you believe takes those fears and ambitions on all sides to one place and can drive us forward?
Yeah.
What's that vision?
And that's why when I woke up and I said, saying you want to build one South Africa isn't just clever, catchy things. It's actually an inherent ambition that says it is possible to live in a country upon which blacks and whites, coloreds and Indians can prosper together and live together peacefully. That's my overarching narrative. I've stayed with it for as long as I've been in politics and will fight for it till the day I die. And part of that is to say to all of those respective groups of South Africans, can we be joined together by values? This value of Ubuntu, this idea that I see you as a fellow human being, before I see all the any other things, I see that. And ultimately, we share common threats. If a snake pulled in here, in this room today, the threat is common to both of us. Therefore, how do we unite together against that? And I'm saying, if we can share common values and then understand that in three priority areas, the economy, education, and ultimately making sure all citizens are safe, those common fears, common threats, are common to all of us, and we can commit to fighting towards those things. I happen to think, this is why I even, in speaking to the Afrikaner community yesterday, said to them, listen, my invitation to you is not to treat yourself as a separate group of South Africans. Come into the full South African story, because your interests and my interests maybe shared. We both have an interest in making sure that all our kids go to school. So maybe in some ways, rather than also just using all of your skills to just build an Afrikaans university, let's work together to build a university in Mpumalanga, a university in the Northern Cape. We can achieve that. And I think that invitation has not come from the political leadership that we've had in the office of the presidency. And because we haven't had that kind of invitation to South Africa to work together,
I think we've lost it. To stand up for them in particular, because I notice every time I drive past the Afrikaner community, I mean, every time I drive past Waterkloof Air Force Base where the Guptas landed, there's that Soltec University they've built there, right? Which is AfriForum, Solidarité, all of those people. I don't think they did that because they thought, well, screw the rest of South Africa. I think they did that because it was evident to them that the ANC had no interest in that community at all. There was no overture made. So that you are going to them is probably a good thing. Okay, I got annoyed with you guys with COVID because I noticed that you were all gung-ho behind lockdowns and all of that stuff. And it's going to take me a while to forgive the DA. I've said this, to forgive you guys. If I were a single issue voter, I probably, and I said this to the IFP the other day, I probably would be on the side of like a devolution of powers. I'd like the community leaders, the councils to have the most power and the national government to have the least power. So can you win me over on one or two of those things? Is there something about that that is more attractive now with the benefit of hindsight than it was at the time? Or am I still going to have issues with you?
No. I mean, on security, you know, I've been calling for the devolution of policing. Because I find it stupid that I drive around Joburg and the Metro Police primary interest is whether my license disc is up to date.
Yeah.
Rather than maybe if I was carrying any ammunition in the car. Right. So perhaps maybe we can aggregate Metro Police, aggregate private security companies and bring SAPs and then innate them with more intelligence to be able to fight crime. Except it's not just exclusively that. It cannot be that because there's a lot of cross-border crime that occurs.
So, but I'm interested in money being devolved.
Devolved.
I'd like the local council to have more of the budget.
I mean, where maybe we'll find each other is that I actually think we must, if not scrap all provinces, reduce them significantly.
Okay, now we're talking.
Because I actually think city-led government. It actually was a function of my master's thesis to say, actually, I think cities have a fundamental role in being able to drive certain things and much more effectively. So I think South Africa's governance model needs to change in that regard. I think that provinces add another layer. They create more complexity. and they create more bureaucracy.
Yeah.
So on that score, I would think hard about how do we strengthen cities, make them much more stronger, give them the most capable leadership, because you don't want pools of money sitting where people are incompetent. Because often you find, to be honest with you, I mean, you don't experience it easily in Joburg. And I know people might look at the mayor of Joburg and be deeply concerned, as I am. And I'm not trying to demean another human being. I think he's not fit for the job.
I'm very concerned, yeah.
But it gets worse when you get to Inokumgijima and you arrive there and people don't know financial literacy and yet manage complicated budgets and all of that kind of thing. So let's focus on strengthening city governance. I do think in terms of powers to determine certain things, I think what we learned during COVID was the nakedness of South Africa failing to think through its own country.
No, I think all of us, just as citizens, we just ignored you politicians and did our own thing. We didn't care what you told us. And there's something you've got to acknowledge about that, because you and Helen and a whole lot of other people always talk about the capable state, but we don't have one. And once people have felt what it's like to not have government, and in many municipalities in this country, it's so rotten and there's such insolvency that people don't feel government at all. So they make a plan. They find their own way to find water, to cook their food, to grow their food. And many of us have forgotten what it's like. I'm not speaking for myself here, but I'm speaking about many South Africans in many parts of this country who just have forgotten what it's like to have government. And we don't need you guys making stupid rules for us where we don't care about your rules. That's the truth.
I was as frustrated in some ways, and I don't want to, I mean, it was just 2020, 2021. So at the period of time, I wasn't part of parliament, so I can only take some of the blame, not all of the blame.
Sure.
As you say. And during that period, I spent those 2 years, we managed to raise some funds to be able to, we distributed over 1.1 million meals during that time, because
that was very good. And I'm glad you brought that up, and you deserve credit for that. But what I'd like is just we shouldn't have closed the schools.
Let him finish.
One of the things, that's...
Just let him finish his thought.
Yeah, what I think you are also saying, though, Gareth, and I think it's an important point here, and this is what I want to learn. I don't think you get it right all the time. I think as a leader, at first, when you're getting imperfect information and imperfect science, as you have to make decisions as a leader, maybe about closures, about shutdowns, maybe at first you go with conventional wisdom that you've learned. I wish that maybe 2 or 3 months into the journey, we would have been able to stop and say, maybe this is not practicable for us. And we were wrong, and be willing to say that to citizens.
Cool.
And I think citizens would be willing to accept a political leadership that's also honest about saying, we get some things wrong. And I pray that one day when we, in the office of president, we'd have the guts to look citizens in the eye and say, I was wrong.
Okay.
One of the things we do know about what happened with COVID is it's also about the money that you take. There's lots of conversations currently happening in the electorate about who pays for what, and he who pays the piper calls the tune. Your fundraising and some of the people that you have declared as people who have donated to your party, you share fundraisers, funders with three parties, with the DA, with Action SA, and some with Rise. Does that mean that you have similar aspirations and that your funders are able to say to you, these are the areas we would want you to concentrate on?
Citizens sometimes find this hard to believe, but I'm willing to even have a forensic done on my phone. There has never, at least of any of the donors that you speak about, who have post facto called me up and said, you'll take this position on this issue or you'll do this on this issue. I raised money even for the DA. I raised money for that. always with the understanding that you're funding and solving for democracy rather than trying to dictate policy. I think often, naturally, when people connect with your values as a leader, you're not going to find a demagogue if you're someone. You're not going to find someone who's nuts. You're going to look broadly and say, do I connect with this guy's values? Are they honest? Are they going to? And let me use someone like who personally has been out, is someone like Martin Moschel, right?
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I'm grateful that Martin funds democracy. Because to be honest with you, funding is a hard game. And there are few people who are actually willing to do it. Because everyone lives with this, oh no, we mustn't get involved with politics. We must hide. And actually, people like Martin, you can be critical of his own faith. You can be critical of his own background. But I can tell you, as night follows days, Martin has never called me up and said, you will work with these people. You'll agree on that policy, etc. Martin and I connect on values, and he helps fund our project, and it helps us fight for the things we want to fight for. So, yeah, and I think it's a helpful thing that the IEC has asked for declarations to come on board.
Yeah, I think that's good, right?
But I want to encourage more South Africans. There are just way too, you know, when you look at the funding pool, people who can give you money, a few in this country, to be honest with you, they're very few. And actually, if it wasn't for those people who had the courage to face the ANC and says, I'm willing to fund the opposition, when so many people are willing to acquiesce to the government because they fear, they cow-cow, they say, well, if we don't fund the ANC and we fund the opposition, our tenders get canceled, mm-hmm. et cetera. Come on, man. Let's rather than make demonizing, as what Twitter and so many other places do, demonize people who at least put their skin in the game, as it were, to the opposition game. Rather than demonizing them, there's a dynamic of me that wants to say I'm grateful for those South Africans, because had they not been there, I can promise you now, you drive down this street, half of the posters you see, to fight a poster is 50 rand per poster, right? It's just in real numbers. The ANC will flight 1.1 million posters. The EFF will do nearly the same. Both those two parties have not declared who they're funding, right? But I have to nearly flight maybe 300,000, et cetera, and declare up front who are the people who have funded me. And those people have never asked me for policy direction. Instead, they wanted me to have a fair chance of competing in this electorate. So to me, I'm grateful for South Africans who are willing to stick it out and fight the fire. But we mustn't demonize them. I think that it's a dangerous ploy when we do that to people who are actually interested in democracy. We mustn't think every funder is a Gupta. It's a flaw. We mustn't think anyone just wants to amass state contracts. It doesn't work like that. And I can sit with anyone. If you want to run a test, you want to do whatever, I'll sit with anyone and demonstrate that to you, because there's never been a time where I've had donors come back to me and say, well, this is the position you must take.
How's all of this impacting? Because campaigning is now in high gear. So you're all over the place. You're working hard, sleepless nights, having to visit people, talk to communities, kiss babies, all that stuff. How's this impacting on wife and kids and the rest of your life, or is it all on hold?
My wife has given this mantra to our kids. We see daddy when we see daddy.
Okay. Right.
But, you know, from the day my first child was born, she arrived back in hospital, and in 3 days I was campaigning for mayor in 2011. So some ways they are kind of used to the election cycle. We've kind of, as a family, made it our mission. And I know it sounds Pollyanna-ish. If you picked up the phone and said, what are we trying to do as a family? I think we try and go, well, we're trying to make this place a better place for all of us. And we're all invested, right? When you've got little kids in this country, you know, whether it's COVID decisions, whether it's really whatever decisions, it sits at home.
Yeah.
I got COVID and I had to rely on what the healthcare in this country needed to tell me about what I needed to do for COVID.
Mm.
So any decision, any choice you make is impactful. That's why if there's a plug for appointing leaders that at least are younger, is that the decisions they make are going to impact their lives and their livelihoods. So when we appoint 80-year-olds, in some ways they are past that point and they're thinking about other things. So it's been tricky.
So speaking of plugs for younger people, it's beyond the time of getting them to go out and register to vote.
Yeah.
But those that are registered, and it is a small number, although we do have this year the highest number of young people, people who haven't experienced apartheid ever before, eligible to vote and registered to vote in this election. What would your message be to them to excite them to come out and vote for Bosa?
I mean, I'd say to them, this is not just their future, it's about their today, right? And I would tell young people to say, who you elect will determine what the cost of your internet is, what job you find, what schools you live in, what how safe your communities are. And I'm saying to them that fair enough, I'm not perfect. I've made my fair share of mistakes and I've had my fair share of successes. I've hustled in this country in the same way as many of them wake up every day to do, because I wasn't born in some silver spoon. And when I left parliament, I was as unemployed as anyone else. So I acknowledge their hustle culture and I want to partner with them to make this country great, because young people hold the key in a continent like Africa where the median age is 23. And I think in the same way as we took a view as a generation to say we must reject all of apartheid, I think now is the time to take a similar view to say, let's reject what is going on with the ANC and choose a different tomorrow. So my invitation to young people is that you can swing these elections. Putting Bosa in the room, there are only 5 people who will decide where this country goes in some ways because of favorability and what happens. You've got Cyril, you've got Julius, you've got me, you've got Jacob, and you've got Helen. I think that's the 5 favorability issues. Put me in, I know.
Did you hear that?
The shade. The shade.
So put me in the room so that I can make decisions that will serve your interest best. And I think even to their parents, I often ask them, I often ask people, who voted for apartheid? And everyone says, I never voted for apartheid. There's no apartheid voters, by the way. They don't exist anymore. They say, everyone denies it.
You can't even find someone who voted no in the referendum.
No, I'm just saying.
Your parents weren't allowed to vote.
And I tell people to say that there will come a day where there'll be no ANC voters because they'll all deny it when we don't have water, electricity, etc. So let's vote to express our hopes rather than think that status quo is normal. It's completely abnormal.
All right. Just a final thing, we always say good luck, and I hope it goes well. If you end up with like 10 seats or whatever, 20 seats, you've got enough people, good people to deploy at this point, because I know you've been recruiting and you've brought in all these other parties.
He's got 240. How many signatures did you get?
So you got enough to fill half of parliament.
Did Julius take your bait? Is he coming to inspect your signatures?
Yeah, I asked him just to bring just a statement as to who funded their rally, because I'm not certain there are enough cigarettes to fund that entire thing.
So. There's a lot of shade being thrown. You can't say Musi My Money has not been exciting this morning.
Look, this election, no one knows. To me, 1 million votes are up to grabs, 2 million votes are up for grabs. And South Africans are, for the first time, considering not doing what they've always done, which excites me about this election for the first time. So I'm telling them that if you want the choice that works for all South Africans, Bosa is the thing. Don't just go there to express your race or your faith. Go there to express
just
your
one
hopes.
Quick thing. You can't have the black background on your posters. With a black man on it. I mean, it's like you're melting into the background here.
I hear you, and the new ones have got a new one. Again, one of these things that sometimes you don't get right. They look great on Instagram, but they may not always on the street.
And on screens, it looks good.
But the new ones are coming out. People have said to me the poster game, because posters are boring, right? Like they're a little bit boring.
They are. Honest.
So
why did you do them?
Why did you do them?
In South Africa, that's the...
Because
you don't got to do nothing but stay black and die. You don't have to do nothing.
No, people are gonna walk to the polling stations. They need to look at the polls and know you are in the game. and posters.
I'm
help
just
you
interested
do that.
In what neighborhood you get what posters, because there's some interesting stuff. What's happening in your neighborhood,
Baba? I've even seen MK.
Ah.
MK posters. You know, I've got two neighborhoods.
Yeah.
That I frequent all the time.
You're half Soweto and half.
Yeah. So it's between my house and Rosebank, which is where I work. There's the Busa posters just went up in Rosebank. And then there's the well-trodden path to my mother's house. And there I go past the hostel. So I go past two hostels to get to my mother's house. And I see lots of MK posters. I see Do It for Shenge. Yeah. I also see a big across the freeway, IFP Setembe. But it's fascinating. And I told you, when I drove past the gauntlet down the M1 with all of the, towards the M2 with all the EFF posters. But they're not there anymore. I think they flew off. But
no, the police took them down. You're not allowed to post on M1.
I want to ask this question, and we're a little bit over the time. Yeah. You're contesting in all 9 provinces.
Sure.
And who are the people you've got in the provinces?
What do you mean by that? You mean candidates?
Who are your candidates in the provinces? Because you're not on every...
Yeah, sure. In KZN, our premier candidate, there's a guy called Ntokozo Biela. I can highlight them because he comes from... I used to be an executive at Unilever. He's worked in micro enterprise. So those are the kind of people.
He's going to have a tough job because KZN is the most contested.
It's wild. But again, it's that kingmaker status, right? Mm. Like to me, this election is not about choosing old parties. It's about deciding who's going to hold the margins. And that's why that's important. In Gauteng, you've got Nobuntu. You know her.
Yeah.
In the Western Cape, you've got a young woman called Lumka and a number of others. She's a phenomenal business executive. She's come on board from there. In the Eastern Cape, you've got an ex-business guy who used to, funny enough, work within the ANC, Umakhoba. In Limpopo, we've got a young guy called Timothy and a number of key candidates who have come out of communities, have been working there. He's been a political activist. In the Free State, you've got a Dr. Diseko, who's worked in academia, has lectured, and is an incredible, incredible South African. In the Northern Cape, you've got an ex-teacher, a woman called Millie, who is now fighting sex offenders in that community. And so she's an activist. So I can take you province by province. There's phenomenal talent. We've got ambassadors. We've got South Africans who have been in business, who have been in politics. I've been in politics for long enough. This is probably one of the best caucuses I've ever had to work with.
In the provincial elections, where do you think you're going to do the best?
Yeah, look, Gauteng is the game, naturally, because 13 million voters reside here, and that's an important proportion of the votes. The recent polls have showed us that we're growing quite significantly, even in KZN, despite the confusion of MK and all of that. Keep in mind that Phoenix and Chatsworth aren't always aligned in that space. And we've got some interesting candidates who come from those communities. The Western Cape is an interesting place because Cape Town, if there's ever a tale of two cities, is that. So if you go to Kukuletu, Kylie Chalanga, that whole community.
And Laleli Banjali, look at you, must leave the Western Cape alone. And
So now we're just trying to sit on the margins. And it's also interesting when you go to places like Beaufort West, etc., and the Karoo, we've got some interesting developments that are taking place there. And then lastly, I think Limpopo and the Eastern Cape. So those are the two major problems.
Okay. All right. Listen, good luck. And we will see you on election day.
Yeah, boy.
Good stuff.
Vote.
Musi Maimane, very nice to have you here. Thank you, everybody. That is The Burning Platform for this morning. And The Real Network continues with plenty of good stuff through the course of the rest of this week. We'll be back tomorrow morning at 6 a.m. Don't miss it. Thanks, Pums.